Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DT Thompson Media. My name is Paul Malik. I am the Courier's political editor, and I am joined this week from reporters once again around the country in Dundee. Joining me, virtually at least, is Derek Healy, the Courier's political correspondent. Good morning, Derek. In Edinburgh, we have Tom Peterkin, the Press and Journal's political editor. Good morning, Tom. And joining us all the way from down south, it is Dan O'Donoghue, the Press and Journal's Westminster correspondent. Good morning, Dan. So we're just going to jump straight into things. It's been another busy week in politics, both Scottish and UK. We have been led with a spending review, given the fact that the coronavirus pandemic has cost the economy billions upon billions of pounds and shows no signs of letting up. Dan, you have been following that from the halls of Westminster this week. Can you talk us a bit through it and obviously the implications that this will have for all of us?
Yeah, it was quite a strange spending review because on the one hand, we're told, you know, the economic emergency hasn't even begun. We're on the brink of the worst recession in 300 years. Government borrowing is going to hit a peacetime record of 400 billion and unemployment this year could go as high as 2.7 million. But then on the other hand, we were also told this week about kind of huge spending plans. You know, there's going to be kind of 16.5 billion given to the military. There's going to be billions for public services and infrastructure. You know, Rishi Sunak, I don't know if he's been rooting down the back of the Treasury couch, but he even managed to find 30 million for a Brexit festival or a festival to celebrate Britain in the post-Brexit world. But I mean, in terms of kind of cash for Scotland, there was kind of an additional 2.4 billion embargo consequentials. This, of course, whenever there's an extra spend on public services in England, there's always an uplift in spending in Scotland. You know, and there was all sorts of other kind of little bits and bobs. There was this kind of an acceleration of these city and growth deals that we've seen over the last couple of years. Plenty of places in our patches will benefit. This is kind of a joint deal signed between the UK government and the Scottish government to kind of help kind of local communities. And there was also kind of investment in kind of broadband and 4G. I mean, that'll be of particular interest in the Highlands and Islands where connections aren't great. And then there's kind of guaranteed funding, kind of almost like parachute payments after Brexit for farmers and fishermen, totaling kind of well over half a billion quid. So yeah, I mean there was a lot in there, kind of as I say, but it was very strange really because we've got all these warnings, but we're kind of also being told, you know, there's loads of cash to spend. So it was quite a strange fiscal event, to be honest.
That's quite a lot to take in. There's one thing that really leapt out there: Festival of Brexit. What on earth is that?
Well, this is something. I mean, I know that kind of Tom was writing about this, but I think it was something that was first proposed by Theresa May a couple of years ago as a way to kind of really appease some of the backbench Brexiteers who were causing her so much bother at the time. It's basically similar to, I think it was a festival that was held in the 50s to kind of just celebrate Britain, basically, and kind of showcase kind of British art, culture, music. But as I say, you know, it was quickly dubbed the Festival of Brexit. I think Theresa May had originally budgeted over £200 million to spend on it, but it's since come down to a more sensible, although still ridiculously high figure of £30 million for this festival.
Wow, that's quite a lot of money to spend on something I'm assuming that we kind of just would be doing anyways. Sorry to get sidetracked there, because I know we have definitely have a very strict script on the Stooshy, and it begs us all to stick to it, especially me. But I that sounds like quite pie in the sky thinking. The spending review, obviously, Scottish politics is not wanting to do without getting embroiled or upset over this. Dan, so there's been quite a few issues surrounding the way that the Holyrood is going to be funded going forward from this, isn't there?
Yeah, so basically we've been waiting for, well, 3 years now. I mean, there's been talk about something called the Shared Prosperity Fund, which essentially is a way for the UK government to replace EU structural funds. So, you know, over the last 40 years while I've been in the EU, you know, Scotland has received, you know, millions, billions of pounds from the EU in funds to kind of build various things such as the Keswick Bridge over in Inverness Way, money's gone towards the University of Highlands and Islands. You know, basically it's a way for the European Union to kind of plough money into to kind of areas that perhaps don't get, you know, a lot of attention from their own national governments, and it's a way to kind of uplift different communities around the EU. The UK government said it wanted to continue with this after we left. So there's this shared prosperity fund. Now, the controversy comes because unlike EU funding, which basically it's bid for and then Brussels will essentially give it, hand it over to the Scottish government to kind of allocate locally, this will be administered centrally from Westminster. So Westminster will decide where or what projects will be funded and what will be built, and it will invite in kind of local MPs and businesses to kind of bid for some of this funding. That, of course, has kind of angered a lot of people in the Scottish government who say, you know, this is kind of cutting us out and it undermines the devolution settlement. And similarly, there was a new fund that was announced called the Levelling Up Fund. I mean, people may have heard this horrible phrase time and time again. It's another one of Boris Johnson's bumper stickers, it would seem. We had get Brexit done and now we've got this. It's kind of he says it's a way to go into kind of, you know, coastal communities, former industrial, post-industrial towns, and kind of, you know, help kind of regenerate them. So there's kind of 800 million quid set aside for Scotland, and it'll be up to kind of local councils, businesses, charities in the area to kind of go directly to the Treasury and ask for a share of this funding, again, cutting out the Scottish government. You know, as I say, it's kind of one where good news and bad news. It's extra money, but it's also, you know, undermining the kind of way that, you know, the fundamental kind of way the UK runs, really. So it's, you know, take from it what you will.
Interesting that in a week, obviously, where Boris Johnson was trying to smooth over the cracks that he caused last week after he said that devolution was a disaster, that he's in fact putting forward policy, or certainly his government's putting forward policy, that further undermines, or could be used to argue that he is further undermining devolution. This is obviously going to have some obvious ramifications for the way politics plays out in Scotland, Tom. No doubt will be seen as another stress test for the union.
Yes, but on the other hand, it could also be seen as you know, you can see that in the run-up to the May election, that there the UK government is wanting to demonstrate that the union, in terms of delivering money and broad shoulders during the coronavirus pandemic, and you know, so that I'm sure that the UK government will argue that this shows the benefits of being in the union, even though, of course, there will probably be a row about the mechanisms themselves.
Well, it would be very fun if there wasn't a row. I mean, speaking of which, Nicola Sturgeon has been back banging the drum for independence referendum as early as next year. Is that right, Tom? You've been following this a little bit.
Yeah, she gave this is ahead of the SNP conference. She gave an interview to a couple of the broadcasters in which she said that she sort of suggested an independence referendum could be held in the early part of the next parliament, which of course has caused a lot of anger amongst the unionists, who say that she ought to be concentrating on getting us out of the economic turmoil of the pandemic rather than, you know, constitutional saber rattling. And of course, you know, this is a prelude to what we're going to see during the next year's a Scottish election campaign. So it's going to be. You know, as ever, it's going to be one of the absolutely key issues in that campaign. It'll be one of the key things that will be up for discussion at a rather unusual SNP conference, which is going to be, because of the restrictions, it's going to be run virtually. So it's going to be a far cry from the rather social events we used to have in Inverness, or these enormous rallies that emerged in the post-referendum years, where, you know, thousands of charged up activists would head to enormous venues in Glasgow. So it's it's going to be a strange conference, and obviously independence will be a huge theme of it as well. And there'll be various other issues that people will be thinking about, but whether, for instance, the Alex Salmond, the inquiry into the way that complaints have been handled, complaints into Alex Salmond being handled by the Scottish Government, that is also one suspects will be the giant elephant in this virtual room as far as the activists are concerned.
Now, dare we tip a toe into the Alex Salmond inquiry? There was, more murkiness this week, but there's also a few more big names that are being sort of drawn out and are expected to give evidence now, aren't there? There was reports, am I correct in thinking, that former Moray MP and Edinburgh would-be MSP Alan Angus Robertson is going to have to give evidence. Do we know much more than that?
That's pretty much it in a nutshell, Paul. He has been asked to submit written evidence to the inquiry. This is the first time that's sort of been suggested that he that they'll want to hear from him. It's interesting, obviously, because he's a former Westminster leader of the party, and they're the MSPs will want to question him on particularly precisely what he knew about allegations of an incident at Edinburgh Airport which is supposed to involve female staff there and Alex Salmond, which Alex Salmond denies. So it's really a question of, we'll have to wait and see on that one at the moment. But there's also, this week there was also this issue of the government failing to produce the legal advice that it got ahead of its defeat in a judicial review by Alex Salmond. It has again come to the ahead this week with MSPs voting. This was a second vote in this sort of vein. A majority of MSPs voted for a Tory motion, suggesting that the government should hand this information over in short order. So it's yet more political pressure being piled on Nicola Sturgeon's government in that respect.
I mean, I sat through the one of the inquiry sittings last week, and Tom, you've been sitting on a number of these panels. The overriding theme seems to be that the Scottish government is really going to hold out on giving its legal advice. It says it's never had to do before, or there's only been one or two instances in the past during inquiries when it's had to do so. We've now had the second debate that the Tories have brought forward, sort of commanding the will of the Parliament, seeing that the government should hand over its legal advice. Do you think they're going to renege and hand it over, or does it look like this is going right the way to back to the courts?
Well, yeah, the Tories are threatening legal action on this, aren't they? I mean, John Swinney has said that it's being considered. And he's going to come back. I mean, one way that this may go is that Mr. Stinney's stance on this is so angering his opponents that there is talk of a vote of no confidence in him on this issue, which potentially might, we'll have to wait and see when this might come to pass. But, that would be a very interesting development. And again, one suspects that the Greens would play a big role in whether or not this would succeed. So there's this inquiry, although there's a lot of frustration that not all of the information is forthcoming, it's sort of developing arms and legs all over the place in terms of what's going to happen next.
And once again, we have diverged from our very strict script here on the studio this week. And I do apologise to my colleagues because that was a little donder down Salmond Inquiry Lane. Tom, you touched upon earlier the virtual conference nature of this weekend's SNP meet. Now, you've been speaking to a former SNP member, and he's quite an outspoken supporter of independence, both from the UK and the EU, Mr. Jim Sillars, and he's had, as usual, quite a lot to say. What has he been speaking to you about this week?
Well, I was interested to speak to Jim ahead of the conference, just because he obviously represents a sort of strand of thought within the party, and he had a different take on IndyRef 2 than Nicola Sturgeon, which I suppose is interesting in itself. I asked him about Ian Blackford's remarks that you know, there could be an there should be an independence referendum as soon as next year. And he dismissed that, saying, you know, we need a huge amount of time. The SNP needs a huge amount of time to, you know, work on the building the economic case for independence in as a result of the upheaval of the coronavirus pandemic and as a result of Brexit. And he was saying he said it'd be very unwise to put a date on when this referendum would be, although he sort of seemed to suggest it would be more to, he would favour it being more towards the back end of the parliamentary term. But he also said that, I mean, I think this is probably pretty self-evident, but he said that the Growth Commission, which was chaired by Andrew Wilson, the former SNP MSP, to create a post-IndyRef 1 blueprint for independence, he said, well, that's just fit for the shredder now because it has no value because, you know, things have changed so dramatically in a way that no one could have possibly foreseen in terms of the virus. So basically he was saying that there's an awful lot of work to be done still, which would, is a different, you know, so how, you know, which does not chime with Nicola Sturgeon's ambition to hold one within the next, well, at the beginning of the parliamentary term.
Now, party political conferences, SNP conference, Tory conference, Labour conference, they are all, you know, as much as it is about the main event, you know, Nicola Sturgeon or Boris Johnson giving the main keynote speech, they are also just as well known for their fringe events. Now, some of these fringe events become so fringe that they get up and out, leave the conference building and the party altogether and form their own party. Derek, you have been speaking to some of these rogue elements within the Yes movement that have decided that the SNP aren't nationalist enough and they want to form their own party. And they've had quite a few wild ideas, Derek, that you have been scoping out. Can you talk us through a few of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been speaking to Scotia Future, which is made up, for those who don't know, of former South Scotland MSP Chick Brodie and his former party colleague Andy Doig, who is a local councillor as well. The party has this week, they're set up basically, their kind of campaign is what they describe as real independence outside the UK and the European Union, which kind of sets them a little bit apart from the SNP, who are obviously quite strongly pro-EU. The parties this week revealed a raft of constitutional policies as a sort of vision of what a decentralised and federal Scotland could look like after independence, including a Glasgow-based House of Representatives. So under this proposal, which is based on the German model of federalisation, Scotland's existing 32 local authorities would feed directly into 15 new federal areas. These would be federal isles, councils and cities, who would be responsible for things like economic development and local emergency services. But one of the really interesting things about this proposal for me, and I think the thing that could potentially raise a few eyebrows, is just how this kind of proposed federal map has been set up. So, for example, Orkney, Shetland and the Western Isles has been stitched into one federal Isles Council, while Glasgow and Edinburgh would be the only cities actually granted federal city titles. More than half of the West Coast would be covered by a Highlands and Argyll and Bute Super Council, which would stretch all the way from John O'Groats right the way to Campbelltown. And Aberdeen and Dundee would fall under council boundary areas with the areas around about them, similar to the sort of Grampian and Tayside NHS board areas. So, I mean, I think this is obviously an extremely... Well, they've worded it this way themselves, have described it as a sort of radical plan, and I think certainly that would be regarded as a radical plan within the SNP quarters as well. They obviously have no affiliation with the SNP now, but I think it's maybe one of the things that will be a bit of a loss in terms of the conference is, as you say, some of the fringe elements won't be able to meet up as easily. Some of those sort of fringe discussions won't be able to take place in the same ways, because it's all going to be very organised and taking place online. So it's a bit of a shame, really. But I thought this kind of added a little bit of that kind of flavour this week ahead of the conference. It's quite interesting ideas.
The super centralised councils, which take into no account of traditional borders. I suppose you can take the boys out of the SNP. now, I know they're the only ones that have come up from the nationalist movement that have made a bit of an interesting take on things. We've also had the SNP's Westminster leader, Ian Blackford, who has been spoken about once or twice during this this panel on his quotes on independence, but he really got into a bit of hot water during the week after sending a tweet to an English photographer. Tom, you looked at this story a little bit. What did he say, and what was the reaction to it? Because was it grace and dignity personified, or has it really
well
just shown the seedy underbelly of what's going on at the
moment? I wonder where you got that dignified and graceful question from, Paul. That particular turn of phrase is interesting in relation to this. So this row erupted when Ian Blackford took to Twitter, responding to a very lovely photograph of the Northern Lights that had been tweeted out by a photographer called Ollie Taylor, and for some reason, Mr. Blackford made the assumption, which turned out to be incorrect, that he's Mr. Taylor was based in the south of England, and Mr. Blackford tweeted, "As you live in the south of England and travel to Scotland is only for permitted reason, I'm sure there will be a valid reason as to why you're posting a photo from the north of Scotland last night." Now, this suggestion that poor Mr. Taylor had broken the COVID rules, you know, precipitated a very angry backlash from people who felt that, well, Mr. Blackford was being incredibly harsh. He wasn't being correct fundamentally at all. It turns out that Mr. Taylor had moved to Caithness some time ago, was taking a picture within 5 minutes of his home. So no COVID rules were broken by Mr. Taylor. And of course, people felt that he'd been very unfairly singled out and called out by Mr. Blackford, who wasn't in full possession of the facts. This, in fact, Willie Rennie, the Lib Dem leader, claimed Mr. Blackford had bullied Mr. Taylor because he thought he was English, and suggested the SNP's politician's behaviour could only add to the problems of anti-English sentiment in Scotland. Mr. Blackford, of course, apologised on Twitter, admitted he was wrong to query the photographer, and deleted his original tweet. He said, "As the local MP for Roscommon Lochaber, I know my constituents feel very strongly about the breaking of travel restrictions that we see across the Highlands and Islands, which puts people's lives and our public services at risk. I will continue to stand up for my constituents who frequently raise these concerns with me, but I recognise that it was wrong to query an individual on Twitter, and I apologise to Mr. Taylor for my earlier post, which I have deleted." So it was a huge row about what Mr. Blackford had said, and it was, of course, raised in the Scottish Parliament, where Nicola Sturgeon said that Mr. Blackford was right to apologise, and that by doing so, he had acted with grace and dignity, which people thought was an interesting phrase to use in the circumstances.
Of course, it's not the first time that Mr. Blackford has gotten in trouble on Twitter for telling certain parts of the country where to go. He did a similar... He did a similar tweet in the summer when people started visiting Scotland and the Scottish countryside once the initial coronavirus restrictions were lifted. Now, our five long-term listeners of the show might be aware of a bit that I kept trying to introduce, which was Stooshy of the Week. And I think it can go to none other than our Border Protector-in-Chief, Mr. Ian Blackford. Congratulations, you have become the tail end of 2020's first ever Stoosh of the Week.
Stoosh of the Week.
Oh dear.
That was wonderful. I'd like to thank our producer Chris for just that fabulous. And on that bombshell, I've been Paul Malik. I've been joined by Tom Peterkin, Dan O'Donoghue, and Derek Healy. Thank you all three. Thank you to listening, and tune in next week at the same time using your same podcast provider. We've been The Stooshie. Bye.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster, and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshie today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshie Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshie from DC Thompson Media.